Welcome to episode 28 of Justice with John Carpenter, a podcast from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. I'm the show's producer, Kevin Steele, and I'm here with your host, John Carpe, who is the president and founder of the center. Today, we're talking about mandatory mask policy. As society opens up after the economically disastrous lockdowns due to the COVID-19 pandemic, to wear or not to wear the mask has emerged as a hot-button issue. At the beginning of the pandemic, public health officials were telling everybody to stop wearing masks because they did no good. And besides that, we had to save the masks, quite scarce, for essential workers. You see, many governments supposedly stockpiling masks for a situation just like this had failed to do so. Now that the pandemic is receding, some jurisdictions are saying that masks are not only recommended for everybody, in some places they are mandatory. This reversal, I speculate, is at the root of a lot of skepticism on this subject. John, let's start within your wheelhouse. What are the charter implications of making masks mandatory?
Well, clearly a government law or policy or edict or health order that makes it a legal requirement to wear masks, and then, you know, backed up with some penalty or consequence or fine, clearly that's a violation of our Charter Section 7, right to life, liberty, and security of the person. The security of the person is implicated by a requirement. I have to put something on my body by force of law that implicates my security of the person, as well as my liberty interests, my freedom to wear or not wear what I please. By way of analogy, if there's a requirement that, you know, we all have to wear a bright yellow t-shirt because apparently that, you know, reduces the spread of COVID, that would be an infringement of my liberty and security of the person interests. For some people, it could also be a violation of their religious freedom if they have a sincere religious conviction that, or conscience-based conviction, whether tied to a religion or not, that they are not to cover their face, then you'd have a charter violation of freedom of religion and conscience as well. But as the starting point, you've got a personal liberty interest and a personal security of the person interest.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, you brought up your analogy. Here's my analogy then. How would this apply to other safety equipment like bicycle helmets or even motorcycle helmets? You know, isn't that the same kind of thing? Is it analogous?
I think that yes, it's analogous. And I think that the government there would have a arguably more compelling rationale, right? Because where this always ends up in is Charter Section 1, which says the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms guarantees the freedom set out in it, subject only to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as may be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. So right off the bat, the Charter says governments can violate our freedoms of speech, conscience, religion, association, assembly, and governments can violate our liberty and our security of the person, and can even violate the right to life for that matter, arguably, if you had capital punishment in the country. Although we've had some hints from the court that would not be allowed. And I'm sure under Chief Justice Wagner, who proudly boasted in 2018 that Canada's Supreme Court is the most progressive in the world, and he's proud of it. So, you know, this man has publicly stated he wants a left-wing activist court that is going to constitutionalize left-wing policies so that they're no longer open for the elected representatives to touch it. That's clearly his vision of the court. He said so himself. So capital punishment is probably off the table, but I digress. But the point is, the governments can violate our right to life, liberty, security of the person, freedom of conscience, religion, association, freedom of mobility to move and to travel. All of these freedoms can be violated, provided that the government comes up with a demonstrable justification and that it's reasonable and that the violations of our freedoms are as small as possible. So on that analysis, a motorcycle helmet, and I have not looked into this, but supposedly There's research out there that the rate of death or rate of severe injury or both is vastly diminished by the wearing of a motorcycle helmet. I've also heard contrary arguments that no, for these reasons, that's not true. But I think the weight of the evidence, at least as understood by politicians and courts, the weight of the evidence is that this is a narrow targeted measure to cover your head with a helmet that is going to have a very targeted, specific health benefit of less head injury or less severe head injury, fewer fatalities.
Right. Okay. So it is theoretically provable. If it got tested in court, then they would go, let's go see the evidence. Well, I guess that's where we are right now. That's why the big debate, we're seeing within living memory, like the beginning of this year, everybody was talking about how ineffective masks were. And this was during the height of the pandemic, when all the deaths were occurring. And then all of a sudden the big change comes. And now that we're into this second wave, which seems to be much less deadly, even though there are cases, there are fewer deaths, all of a sudden they want to make masks mandatory. Now, I don't know whether that's because they're pushing to reopen and they need to reassure people that they're taking steps. I'm not sure exactly what the justification for it is, but I know that it's a pretty hot button issue and some people are getting pretty steamed up about it in public. I think we've been informed that people have been contacting the Justice Center about it as well. So
the Justice Center is getting a lot of queries about masks and a lot of people are urging us to challenging court any mandatory mask wearing, which I'm told is now mandatory in Toronto and Ottawa. Going back to what you said a minute ago, it is bizarre because if ever there was a time to mandate the wearing of masks, and this presupposes that they are effective in reducing the spread of COVID, if ever there was a time for it, it would have been March 15th, March 30th, April the 5th, April the 15th. That would have been the time to say, look, we need to take every conceivable possible measure because this is an unusually deadly virus that threatens everybody, blah, 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 blah. That would have been the time for it. We're now at a point, I was just looking this morning, and we are recording this today on July the 14th. Happy birthday, France. And
France, happy birthday. What? Okay.
The storming of the Bastille.
Oh, right. Yeah.
On July the 14th. That's their, okay. It's their national holiday, as I understand it.
That's fine. Yeah. Okay.
In our tiny little Alberta, population 4.4 million people, the COVID deaths right now are 161 COVID deaths. 3% of those deaths are in people under 60. One death, the youngest person to have passed away, 27 years old. This 3% are all people with serious underlying health conditions, immune compromised, and they are people who are also threatened by all kinds of things, not just COVID. So these deaths are a tragedy. All deaths are a tragedy. And the fact that these deaths are a tragedy should not stop us from actually taking a look at the evidence if we truly want evidence-based public policy. So we have 97% of deaths in Alberta are people ages 60 and over. And more specifically, 91% of the deaths are people ages 70 and over. And more than two-thirds of the deaths are people ages 80 and over. So we know that the virus it's out and about. It's spread everywhere. And the fatalities are people primarily in nursing homes, people who are very elderly, and in most cases, very sick. Now, the other relevant thing, every death is a tragedy. In Alberta, in our province with 4.4 million people, there are 27,000 deaths per year. So average that out, there's more than 2,000 people that die every single month. And I haven't looked at the monthly stats. Maybe some months are 1,500 and others are 2,500, depending on whatever factors. But we have more on average, every month, there are more than 2,000 people who die in Alberta of cancer and car accidents and heart disease. And so death is a part of life. death is sad. The fact that death is sad should not delude us into thinking that we can prevent death entirely, because it's not going to work, because people are going to get cancer and people are going to drive cars and get killed in car accidents. Death is a part of life. So you have 2,000 deaths per month, 27,000 deaths per year, and then you have deaths from COVID, 161 people. Compare that to 27,000 over the course of a year. So for anybody to say that this is an unusually deadly killer, that may have been true in March as a theory. You know, it was certainly part of Premier Jason Kenney's modeling, April the 8th, and, Dina Hinshaw, the chief medical officer. Premier Kenney and Dr. Hinshaw said that as many as 32,000 Albertans could die of COVID. And federally, you know, we had similar outrageous claims made by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and the chief medical officer that at least 50,000 Canadians were going to die, while we're closer to 9 or 10,000. So a fraction of the bare minimum. And they said as many as 350,000 Canadians. And I find it profoundly troubling that here we are in July, which isn't March, April, May, June, July. We're 4 months into this, and we are living as though these demonstrably false claims made in March are somehow the truth. And that ties in with masks insofar as why are we going to such great lengths to prevent the spread of something which, yes, it is a particularly nasty, vicious flu. And, it is higher, the death rates are higher than many other flu years and lower than some others. It is particularly nasty and vicious. But why these extreme lengths and measures is a question I don't have the answer to. But it seems to me unfounded in relation to the hard data that's coming out. And these figures are similar in other jurisdictions. I mean, I'm fixating on Alberta, but you look at Ontario, you look at British Columbia, you look at you look at the United States, Italy, the United Kingdom, you look at all these countries, and this is a nasty, vicious flu that is a serious threat to people over 70, over 80, who are already very sick. Those are the people who are threatened by it. And yet we've got public policies that are predicated on this idea that somehow all of us should be living in a state of fear, and all of us should be trying desperately to avoid this virus. And the thing you never hear talked about is herd immunity. I've been told by more than one doctor that that is settled medical opinion, that the way to deal with the virus is you allow it to spread amongst people that are young and healthy and strong, who will not be harmed by it. And then once the infection rate gets up to a high, 50, 60, 70, 80%, the virus effectively stops becoming a threat because it has no place to go, because it can't spread itself anymore because everybody's had it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So first you get it to spread amongst the healthy people, and then you get to a point where it becomes relatively, not 100, nothing's 100%, but it becomes not this dire grave threat to elderly people in nursing homes because the virus is no longer moving and spreading because we've acquired that population immunity. That is how we've been dealing with viruses for 6,000 years. And to now do this, stop the spread. And it seems the whole goal has shifted. Mm-hmm. This is important under the Charter. The Charter asks, what is the pressing and substantial policy that you're trying to achieve, that the government's trying to achieve, right? So you want to make masks mandatory. Okay, why are you making masks mandatory? Well, if it's to stop the spread, I'd like to know how does that relate to acquiring the population immunity or herd immunity, which settled medical opinion says is the way to beat a virus. Why are we trying to stop the spread entirely? And is this even possible? And is it desirable? Because in terms of flattening the curve, I mean, we've had, there's the Angus Reid poll that came out last week, obviously not scientific and might not have had a perfect sample, and the responses were subjective, but it suggests that as many as 40% of Canadians did not get the medical care and attention in March, April, and May that they needed. Now, did 40% of Canadians die from not? Of course not. We don't have 40% of the population dead because we didn't get access to healthcare. But we have got more and more cases coming out of people that did not get their cancer diagnosis, did not get their cancer treatment. And of course, we had the tragedy in Ontario, where we actually have the data that over 30 people, cardiac patients died because their heart surgery was canceled.
Mm-hmm. Just to get back to the volume of people contacting the Justice Center, are they contacting you because they are facing tickets? They're holding tickets saying, I got this because I walked into a store without a mask? Or are they just saying, can we stop this before it spreads, you know, the whole thing, so I don't have that crazy lady in the grocery store filming me on her phone and setting it up on TikTok, shaming me for not wearing a mask? I mean, just as an example, I mean, do you have any idea of how these complaints are coming in?
Well, we're getting them, you know, people are emailing or info@jccf.ca. I suspect that the reason is that we are one of the few organizations in Canada that is calling politicians out on their failure thus far to justify the charter violating lockdown measures, the lockdown measures that violate our charter freedoms to move, travel, associate, assemble, worship, and so on. We're one of the few organizations in Canada, perhaps the only one, that is saying to the politicians, hey, listen, the Constitution of Canada requires you to justify these violations of charter freedoms, and the charter places the onus on the politicians to show with evidence, not just assertions, but evidence that the lockdown measures have done and are doing more good than harm. And because so few other groups are saying this, I think people are gravitating towards us and contacting us because there aren't too many other groups to go to. Even some of the think tanks, and I love the work that they're doing. I mean, the Macdonald Laurier Institute has done some fantastic research and papers. The Fraser Institute has done some good work. The Frontier Center for Public Policy, they come to mind as organizations that are doing some very good public policy analysis. I think the Montreal Economic Institute as well has done some great work. But they are perhaps a little bit less – well, they're not legal think tanks. They're not public interest law firms. So they're not demanding that the politicians carry out their duty under the charter to show demonstrably that lockdowns are doing more good than harm. So we're one of the few voices in Canada, and I think that's the reason why people are contacting us.
Right. Not to steal your thunder there, but I will point out that the Ontario Civil Liberties Association came out with a paper, which was kind of like a meta study. It came out in April of this year, called Masks Don't Work, a review of science relevant to COVID-19 social policy, written by a...
Denis Rancourt?
Yeah, Rancourt. Yeah, you're aware of this then, eh? Yeah, this actually is pretty... It's kind of like a meta study where they look at the various papers that have been issued on this. And they, you know, the conclusion... Well, obviously, it's in the title. Masks don't work. So you're familiar with this then?
I have not read the paper in detail, but this is an example of what, if there is a court challenge to mandatory masks, the onus would be on the government to demonstrate that COVID is an unusually deadly killer that warrants this. The government would have to demonstrate that people who are not sick can and do spread COVID-19. So again, that's another thing that's subject to debate and the science is not settled, but the onus would be on the government to show that, you know, if you're healthy and you've got no symptoms, no sore throat, no fever, no shortness of breath, nothing, you're perfectly healthy, that you are actually a spreader of COVID. The onus would be on the government to demonstrate that. The onus would be on the government to, I guess, disprove or question or invalidate the settled medical opinion that herd immunity is the best way to contain and deal with a virus. Because if the masks are effective, they would be inhibiting the acquisition of population immunity. And Is that a good thing? I mean, the onus would be on the government to show that it is good for us to not develop herd immunity in contrast to what we've been doing for thousands of years with viruses, which is to, you know, let it spread amongst the healthy in order to protect the vulnerable. So the onus would be on the government on all those fronts. And those would be the issues at play in a and then the flip side of that, so the government would have to show all of those things, okay? Mm-hmm. But then the other factor is, you know, the government would probably argue that wearing a mask is a very minimal, that it's not a big deal. And so that this is not a significant violation of your personal freedoms. Oh, and on okay. that opens up another, you know, a bunch of what about deaf people that depend on lip reading? I guess you make you're allowed to take off your mask if you're trying to communicate with somebody who's deaf, hard of hearing, that relies on lip reading. You know, what about people with health issues that experience breathing difficulties and headaches from wearing a mask?
Bad breath. Yeah, that's another one.
What about the health risks from the contamination of masks? Because if you're out and about and you're touching doorknobs, you know, I was at a theater a few weeks ago in South Calgary, and you know they had all these crazy precautions. They had the squirt bottles with the disinfectants, and you know, you had to stand 6 feet apart in line, and the cashiers are wearing masks, and after every customer, they've got the cloth and they're squirting down the counter. But I saw one person paid for his popcorn by cash, you know, gave in a 20, got back $5 and change, and, you know, walked in. And I remember when I was 4 years old, my mother said, you know, always wash your hands after handling money. Money is filthy. You know, you don't know how many hundreds or thousands of people have touched that quarter, which has been in, you know, New Brunswick and British Columbia and Saskatchewan. So always wash your hands. So you got people with you know, handling cash. Anyway, after all of these screening procedures, we get to the, you know, it's like any other theater number 1, 2, 3, 4. You have all these separate theaters, and there's a door handle there, which I have to grab the door handle and push it down to open the door to get into the theater. So, I mean, if it's ridiculous, because if you really wanted to kill all the germs, you should have, how many people would you need to hire? I guess one person per theater to squirt down the door handle with disinfectant every time somebody touches the door handle to go into the theater to sit down and eat their popcorn. I mean,
well, that's, you know, you're being realistic, and I don't think that's the goal here. Like I said, with the masks, the goal, I think, is just to reassure people. In other words, it's not scientific. It's just sort of it's like a sugar pill, you know, to reassure people that they can go back to work now. You know, that seems to
be it reassures, that. But it also promotes the fear, because every time that you see someone wearing a mask, there's a message that's contained with that we are dealing with an unusually deadly killer that we should be very, very afraid of. That's a key psychological issue. I don't know how that would play itself into the charter analysis, but I think it's a double-edged sword when people say, well, it provides comfort to, you know, people that have believed, sadly, claims by the likes of Jason Kenney and Dina Hinshaw and other premiers and politicians and health officials, you know, with these false claims about tens of thousands of people dying in every province and hundreds of thousands of Canadians dying and millions of people dying around the world. It's one thing to say, well, we need to reassure people who have bought into that, that have not looked at the facts now that we're 4 months down the road. Maybe a lot of masks make some people feel safe. However, I think that they instill a lot of fear in a lot of people, because every time you see somebody wearing a mask, it's a message that we should be very, very afraid of something that is an unusually deadly killer, when in the context of death being part of life and how many people are dying, that's simply not true.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think other people have pointed out that it can engender a false sense of security as well, because it is actually – the science actually goes against the ubiquity of masks. And so people would be lulled into thinking, well, I don't need to social distance because I'm wearing this mask, et cetera. You know, I've read that as well. So I'm sure that plays into it somewhat. I think they even mentioned that in this report that the masks don't work as well. Because I mean, we've seen that argument. They've actually included that argument about it making people feel better in their sales pitch, you know, like, oh, it's going to help calm everybody down. But again, could cause a false sense of security.
Anyway. And it gets trivialized too. People go, it's just a mask. Mm. Well, you could say it's just a prohibition on singing in church. You can still go to church. It's just a prohibition for Catholics that want to receive communion on the tongue because you can still go to mass. It's what does that just? It's just a vaccine. It's just an immunity passport that you need in order to get onto an airplane. It's just
a chip under your skin.
Yes. This is how freedom is lost. It's bit by bit by bit. We see it on the by way of analogy. We see it with free speech. I'm 52 years old. I grew up in the 70s and 80s. My wife maintains I haven't grown up at all. She's probably correct. But speaking in layman's terms, you know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and I remember, you know, if you disagreed, you'd say, well, you know, you're wrong, and here's why, or you might ignore the person. Never do I remember there being calls, you should not be allowed to say that. You should be silenced. You should be removed from your position as a university professor. You should be fired as the executive vice president of that corporation. You should lose your job because of that viewpoint. That was never heard. Now we're in disastrous territory where, you know, if you publicly criticize Black Lives Matter, and you say that if somebody expresses the opinion that it's a bad organization or it's left wing or this or that, and you can lose your job for expressing a political opinion, even outside of the workplace, you can lose your job. How do we get there? Bit by bit by bit by bit by bit by bit. And we have, compared to 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, we have a lot less free speech now. How do we get here? Bit by bit by bit, by all these little compromises. Oh, well, it's just, you know, we don't need to worry about Human Rights Commission prosecuting Bill Whatcott because that's just, you know, he's just extreme and, you know, he says hurtful things and it's okay to, it's okay for the government to prosecute him for saying homophobic things. And that's okay. We'll allow that. We won't stand up for him because we're still okay. We can talk about whatever we want, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, not true, because now you've got Antifa and Black Lives Matter, who are arguably, and I have not looked into this closely, but some argue that they're involved in violence and looting and, you know, quasi-terrorist this and that. Okay. Maybe that's not true. Maybe it is true. It should be explored and debated, right? The question is, it's not whether it's offensive or not. The question is it true or not? Hmm. So now we're at a point where you've got these organizations which are almost beyond criticism. You have Rex Murphy being excoriated, even by his own colleagues, for putting forward some arguments as to why Canada is not a racist country. And he makes a number of arguments which, like any argument, they could be challenged, they could be refuted, people could disagree. And all you hear is this hit, you know, oh, well, he's a racist because he argues that Canada is not a racist country, and he puts forward reasons. I have yet to hear any of his arguments being refuted. I'm not saying they can't be refuted. Maybe he's dead wrong. Maybe Canada is a racist country. But the state of free speech is such that we don't have discussions about it. We just have name calling for anybody who disagrees with the opinion put forward by Rex Murphy that Canada is not a racist country. How do we get there step by step? So the danger with the masks, it's analogous to, you know, the people that were okay with, you know, Bill Whatcott, you know, a well-known activist with socially conservative views who articulates those views in a manner that most social conservatives don't like and don't agree with. It's like, you know, social conservatives would say, I know what you're trying to say, and I agree with the sentiments, but your choice of words is absolutely disastrous. That would be kind of the response of social conservatives to Bill Whatcott. And yet people have applauded. He was on campus at the University of Regina with another activists, and they're handing out flyers, and they're saying that homosexuality is a sin, and that it's bad for your health on a medical, biological level, and that homosexual activity can cause diseases, and that it's immoral and it's against God's law and so on. And they're peacefully handing out flyers. Now, I recognize this is highly unpopular speech. The police were called in. You know, that's sort of kind of normal response you'd expect from a university to arrest somebody on campus for saying something unpopular. This is also where we're at. The police are called in. They demand that Bill Whatcott and this other person leave campus immediately, and they didn't comply immediately. They got handcuffed and put into a police wagon and taken off campus, and the crowd of students cheered and applauded. And, you know, this is like, okay, so now if that speech can be shut down because it's unpopular, well, fast forward a decade. Well, now we can't have we cannot have an intellectually honest discussion about racism. We cannot have a discussion about whether or not Canada is a racist country. Yes or no? Why or why not? We cannot have that discussion. Why? Because 10 years ago, like every time you give up a little piece of that freedom to discuss controversial topics, sensitive topics, topics that hit home to people personally, like homosexuality being an example. Abortion is also a very personal topic. I mean, there's a large percentage of the population are people that have had an abortion or have been involved in that in some way, shape, or form, you know, either medically or family member or whatever, right? So these things hit home. But when you give up a space of that, of debate, and you say that, you know, this topic is no longer subject to any debate, well, the noose tightens, right? So 10 years ago, it was deemed by a lot of people to be okay. We cannot talk about homosexuality. And now 10 years later, now we can't talk about race or racism in any manner other than name calling. And so transpose that to masks, right? The issue—
That's what I'm hoping you'll do.
So the issue with masks, you can say, well, it's just a covering on your face. Okay, but it is clearly it's a violation of a person's freedom to wear or not wear what they want for whatever reason that they want it. It's clearly a violation of your personal freedom. So if we acquiesce to that on grounds that, well, this is not really a big deal, well, then where does that put us when we are when other measures are brought down, like, well, you must get a vaccine, or
that's the big one,
or you must have an app on your phone that shows all your whereabouts, so that if you're tested for COVID and we find out you have COVID, we can look on your cell phone and we can figure out every place where you've been in the last, you know, 2 weeks, and every person you've been in contact with at the grocery store or at your mosque or synagogue or church or at your gym, if they're even, well, they're starting to reopen in Alberta, whatever, right? This contact tracing is a huge violation of your personal freedom, and it's huge big brother power to the state. But if we just acquiesce to masks, then, you know, what grounds do we have to stand on to say, well, I don't want to have an app that tells the government every place where I've been in the last 2 weeks or the last 2 months?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it is. That's why they're forcing the issue, to get everybody to get the shame crowd going, so that they can bring in these further measures. I'm not sure. I mean, it is, I suppose, a slippery slope argument that you're making there. I don't need to suppose that it is actually a slippery slope argument.
But it's very much slippery slope. Yeah. But we've seen it in, we've seen it. The free speech example is a prominent one, where we acquiesce to more and more restrictions on our speech. And then we get to a point where, you know, University of British Columbia, we're on the verge of filing a statement of claim because Andy Ngo, who is a reporter who's done a lot, who was actually assaulted and attacked by Antifa in 2019 while covering protests in Portland, Oregon. Andy Ngo, NGO is the spelling, I believe, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. He was invited by the Free Speech Club at UBC to speak on January the 29th, and the university confirmed the booking. And then the university suddenly said, oh, well, there are safety and security concerns. And we understand that Mr. Ngol was himself a victim of Antifa violence, which is why we're going to cancel the event, because we can't have safety and security risks. It's a summary. That's not the exact words of the university.
Okay. Where is this an update on that? Do you had an update there? Is that where we're headed with that?
I think we'd announced previously that we would be moving ahead with a court action, but now that the courts are slowly reopening, we are moving ahead with that.
Oh, okay. All right. Good. All right. So just to be clear on the whole mask thing, we're back to the situation where somebody has to bring in a charge, right? Is that right? Somebody has to have a ticket in their hand and bring it to the Justice Center in order for it to go forward into a court action? Or is there another way to fight this thing?
The best court action to fight against is if somebody gets a ticket.
Right. Okay. So that's where we're at.
You know, okay. It is possible to commence a court application and seek a declaration to the effect that the rule is unconstitutional. But you have a far better fact scenario when you're talking about an individual, particularly if it's somebody that has some health concerns and has medical reasons for not wearing a mask.
Right. Well, if you recall a couple of months ago, we actually had the Premier of Ontario, Ford, saying that it's quite all right for everybody, you know, that for businesses to chuck people out of their premises if they're not wearing masks. We actually made a little fun of that because, of course,
I don't think Premier Ford understands human rights legislation.
Right. But he seemed to get
businesses lost. Businesses once upon a time did have an unfettered right to toss out any person for any reason, but that has not been the case now for a good 40 years or more, because human rights legislation says that, you know, yeah, you can still toss somebody out for bad behavior. Possibly you can get away with no shoes, no shirt, no service.
Isn't that the same as this? No, not quite. Yeah.
I think if the one of the human rights issues that's going to come up is the exemptions for people with medical reasons and whether human rights legislation applies. Mm. So a business cannot discriminate against a customer on the basis of disability. And if a human rights tribunal found that a person's need to not wear a mask was a disability, then the store cannot discriminate against somebody on the basis of that disability. But then too, the store does have a right to try to raise arguments about the need for mask wearing on some, you know, medical, scientific, and other grounds.
Right. Well, I was kind of wondering whether it would happen that you would see it a situation something like this where you would somebody gets tossed out of a store, and could they come then to the Justice Center and say, look, I went to go buy this thing at this store and they chucked me out and I'm really angry about it. And can I do anything about it? Can I get these people on something? And,
filing a human rights complaint is the only option that comes to my mind. I stand to be corrected if there's other things that a person could do. So if they came to us, we would, like we look at all of our cases on a, no pun intended, a case-by-case basis.
Well, there was another situation that popped up over the last week that you had written a column about in the Post-Millennial, and that was the case of a lawyer who had lost a position. Well, you could probably describe it better than I can, because of his opinions on Black Lives Matter. Perhaps you could go into that column. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Leighton Gray is a lawyer in Alberta. He's based in Cold Lake in the north part of the province, although his law firm also has a Calgary office. He's an Aboriginal guy. He has a lot of clients who are Aboriginals who are suing the government over what transpired at residential schools. So amongst his clients, he has residential school abuse victims or survivor claims. He's got a very stellar record of community involvement, numerous awards, the Alberta Stars Volunteer Award and Access to Justice Award for his work with legal aid, Champion of Justice Award given to him by the Alberta Civil Trial Lawyers Association. So a very impressive record of community involvement, coaching minor hockey, being involved in a community sports association that he founded that that helps youth with sports as well as academically. So, in fact, somebody with such an impressive curriculum vitae that the provincial government sought him out to serve on the Provincial Court Nominations Committee. Now, the federal government appoints the Court of Queen's Bench judges, so the superior courts, so that would be the Supreme Court of British Columbia, Alberta Court of Queen's Bench, Ontario Superior Court of Justice, so on. So the superior courts are appointed by the federal government. But you have a provincial civil court, small claims court, you have provincial family court, provincial criminal court, provincial traffic court, and it's the provincial government that appoints judges for those provincial courts. So the Alberta government invited Leighton Gray to appointed him to the provincial court judges nominations committee. So this would be a committee that would look at, you know, incoming applications, nominations. I don't know the details of the process. Leighton Gray also happens to be a libertarian in his political views, and so he, like any citizen, wants to express his opinions publicly. And at one point, he posted something about Black Lives Matter is a leftist lie. And there's video there. I think they're called the Conservative Twins. It's these two black guys that are on this video, and they're saying all lives matter, and they're saying that Black Lives Matter is ridiculous. And I have not looked into Black Lives Matter extensively, but I will say it should be like anything else. It should be a matter of public debate. Is this a good organization? Is it a bad organization? What are its beliefs? That should be open for discussion like any other topic. But we've got this stifling orthodoxy now that basically says you cannot criticize Black Lives Matter. And if you do, then you're a racist and you're a heinous individual that is unfit to hold any position of influence or to hold any position of authority in society. So the CBC ran a smear piece on Leighton Gray, and they said that he was an extremist and a racist and an anti-Semite, and that he's not fit to serve on this nominations committee. And the Alberta's opposition NDP leader of the opposition, Rachel Notley, and leader of the NDP, called on the Kenney government to remove Leighton Gray from this provincial court judges nominations committee. Rachel Notley, it is, I think, interesting and relevant, has stated publicly that Catholics are okay with rape within marriage. And she knows that accusation is false. And yet, you know, she has yet to apologize for publicly promoting hatred against Catholics by saying falsely that Catholics are okay with non-consensual sex, right? Which obviously is not true. And people in glass houses should not throw stones if we're going to have some kind of a litmus test on acceptable public statements. But I digress. She called upon Jason Kenney's government to remove Leighton Gray from the committee, and the government then pressured Leighton Gray and said, yeah, you got to resign, you got to resign, you got to resign. And so he caved into that pressure and he resigned from the committee. Then it gets worse. Then the Law Society of Alberta sends Leighton Gray a letter on June the 22nd without warning, without any kind of, you know, due process or, you know, here's what we're concerned about. Please explain yourself. Nothing, no due process. Without warning, the Law Society of Alberta, which is a government body, which is the gatekeeper to the legal profession, sends a letter to Leighton Gray informing him that he has been removed from the adjudicator pool of lawyers who review disciplinary complaints. And how the Law Society works is that, you know, people who are unhappy with their lawyer or with any lawyer can file a complaint against a lawyer and accuse that lawyer of breaching the code of conduct or code of ethics. So there's kind of a pool of lawyers who serve on, you know, reviewing these complaints, and Leighton Gray was one of the people holding this position. I assume it's volunteer. I doubt that it would be a paid position. And he gets a letter saying, you're no longer on the adjudicator pool. So he's removed.
Did they letter say what? State,
yeah, they did. Said because of recent media coverage, and because you're no longer on the provincial court judge's nomination committee.
Oh, I see. One led to the other.
It's kind of they want to join the bandwagon, you know. They've got hey, Rachel Notley said that he's a racist, extremist, anti-Semite, so obviously that must be true, so let's act on it.
Let's take disciplinary and abetting this cancel culture, of course. Now that story you referred to, was that the June 23rd CBC piece, Alberta government won't apologize for appointee critics say made racist, anti-Semitic posts? June 23rd? Is that the one you're talking about? Charles Russell?
Well, there's two CBC pieces. There's at least two. There could be more. Okay. The first one, I think, goes back prior to June 22nd by a week or two or possibly longer. So yeah, the first CBC smear job.
Oh, and this is the reaction. Okay.
And the first one, you know, they call they phone left-wing advocates and get quotes saying, oh yeah, you know, what Leighton Gray says is extremist and this is not fair, it's not equitable, and how could you possibly have somebody with those kinds of views serving on the provincial court nomination committee?
Right.
That's sort of just a typical CBC smear piece. And then the NDP took that and ran with it. And then Jason Kenney did the NDP's bidding and pressured, maybe not Jason Kenney personally, but the Kenney government pressured Leighton Gray to resign. And then the Law Society says, oh, me too. They want in on this McCarthyist type of a witch hunt. And so they fire off a letter to Leighton Gray saying, well, you're not on the committee anymore.
Right. Yeah.
Sorry, you're not on the adjudicator pool anymore.
Yeah, I noticed that. The reason I pointed that out is because of the quote that I see in the piece. Quote, he promoted extreme right anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that Jewish billionaire businessman George Soros was manipulating European judges and funding the worldwide Black Lives Matter movement for his own evil agenda, which I found kind of funny because, you know, apparently that's the rule in Canada is you can't criticize George Soros without being accused of being anti-Semitic. That is pretty much standard practice in the mainstream media to throw that out. Interesting enough, today, George Soros and his Open Society Foundation announced $220 million for Black Lives Matter and associated type groups.
What do George Soros and the Open Society Foundation, what do they themselves say? Because we were discussing this briefly before the podcast.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was a piece in Summit News that quoted from an interview that accompanied the Open Society Foundation's press release. And they said that they are doubling down on their investment on funding
Black Lives Justice organizations.
Yes.
Black-led justice organizations.
Yeah, that's right. And the other quote was, this is the moment we've been investing in for the last 25 years. So
it sounds like George Soros or his foundation is giving money to Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm. And been doing funding organizations like this for a long time. I mean, I've done a lot of reading on Black Lives Matter. So, I mean, I'm not going to lay out the whole case against them, but it's pretty obvious. Their founders have admitted to being trained Marxists, you know, that
I'm not an expert on them either, but they've said on their website that they are socialists and they are against the family unit. They want to break down the family and replace it with something else, which, and I support their free speech rights to advocate for that. If their beliefs are socialist or dismantling the traditional family, in a free country, you have a right to advocate for that. What is sick about our culture is that there's this moving away from the question of, is this true or not? Mm-hmm. Rather into, you know, is this offensive or not? And if it's offensive, you can't say it, because, you know, if this information's correct, then it appears to be a fact that George Soros is funding or has funded Black Lives Matter or similar groups. So if that's a fact, if it's a fact that he's Jewish, well, if he's Jewish, he's Jewish. I mean, I hate anti-Semitism with a passion. I consider myself to be pro-Jewish and pro-Israel in terms of my own political outlook. But if there's some Jewish guy doing something that you disagree with, and if it's a fact that he's Jewish, I mean, I just don't get how that turns into anti-Semitism.
Well, for some people it does. I mean, their criticism is based in anti-Semitism. You can see that in some places. That does happen. But of course, you know, the default position, like I say, in Canada's mainstream media seems to be any criticism of Soros ends up in that camp, regardless of whether it's stated or not.
At any rate, Black Lives Matter has also been accused of anti-Semitism. And mm-hmm. I don't know if the accusation's fair or not. There was a protest or a march where people are chanting anti-Israel slogans. And of course, that's a whole other area of debate. You know, is anti-Israel necessarily anti-Semitic? That's a whole other debate. But the troubling thing is this movement away from debate and away from asking the question, is this true or false? Or, you know, is it partially true, partially false? Moving so viscerally away from that question of what is true or false into it's offensive, therefore you can't say it.
Well, not only if you do say it, you will be removed from this.
Well, and then it's further. I mean, yeah. You know, social ostracism has always been part of the landscape, and I think that's just where the chips fall. I mean, if you're a Holocaust denier, which is an unpopular opinion, and you know, I'm glad it's unpopular. I mean, I think it's a wrongheaded, false opinion, and in many cases, likely is motivated by anti-Semitism. But that said, social ostracism has always been part of the landscape. So if you're going to be a Holocaust denier, you're not going to get invited to the nice dinner parties, and you're probably not going to get ahead socially. The social thing is one thing, but when you get a government body like the Law Society that is removing somebody from a position based on some cheap shot name calling on the part of the CBC and the NDP, and then just acting politically to damage somebody for not agreeing with left-wing orthodoxy on something like Black Lives Matter, a lawyer in Alberta or anywhere else should be able to say whatever they want about Black Lives Matter. And if somebody wants to say that it's a bad organization or that it's a leftist lie, well, that's an opinion. And the Law Society should not be policing the opinions of the political opinions of lawyers at all.
Right. And according to what you told me, they kind of stepped in with this extra step that nobody was really asking for. In other words, it kind of came out of the blue. That's the way you represented it to me. Is that my understanding?
Well, June 22nd, Leighton Gray got a letter out of the blue informing him that he had been removed from the adjudicator pool. Mm-hmm. So to my knowledge, there was no due process, which is another thing the Law Society of all organizations, if they're going to punish you for something or inflict some kind of a consequence on you, they owe it to you to tell you that, you know, what you've done wrong and listen for an answer and give you a fair opportunity to respond to the accusation and then have a fair process in place, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You don't just fire off a letter to somebody informing them that they've been removed from a position. That is not what I would expect from the Law Society of Alberta, of all organizations.
Right. Unpopular opinions leading to decisions by government bodies that should be governed by the Charter, right? Isn't it?
Well, they are. The Charter of Rights and Freedoms applies to law societies, you know, something mm-hmm. the majority of the Supreme Court of Canada didn't get right in its Trinity Western decision in 2018, mm-hmm. when the Supreme Court basically treated Trinity Western University as though it was a government entity with some obligation to accept everybody to come there, including people that are disagreed with Trinity Western's beliefs and theology and did not want to abide by the community rules that are in place, somehow Trinity Western was expected by the Supreme Court to behave like a government actor and just welcome in even people who disagreed with the university's mission and vision and beliefs and code of conduct and so on. And then the law societies, which actually are government bodies, which are legally required to respect freedom of association and freedom of religion, they were excused from their nefarious trampling on the charter freedoms of Trinity Western University. I mean, the court got it completely backwards.
Okay. Well, that doesn't bode well.
Because it does not.
Especially when we're talking about charter challenges. That is pretty much the basis of the show here. And you're telling me now that the Supreme Court has turned it all upside down.
Well, it's an atrocious decision, but, yeah. You know, with everything else, you try to mitigate the damage as best you can. And you still move ahead and move forward and try to distinguish the decision and explain to the court why this fact scenario now before the court, why the Trinity Western decision does not apply to it. Mm-hmm. And conversely, the government, you know, will be making the argument that, oh, yes, the Trinity Western decision of the Supreme Court very much applies to this, right?
So, right. Well, for Leighton Gray, does he just let it go at this point? Is that what's happening? Or is there something else going on that he might – is there a charter challenge? Is there anything that's happening?
Well, at this time, to my knowledge, he's just contemplating his options. So no announcements at this point.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I guess we'll leave it at that and probably call it a day. The end of episode 28 of Justice with John Carpe. Thanks, John. And, well, we'll hopefully speak to you next week.
All right. Talk to you next week, Kevin.